This is an interview with James L. Williams for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program regarding steelworkers by Mary Kay Scholes at 246 Wilson Avenue, Struthers, on February 12th at 10:30 a.m. Okay, Mr. Williams, let's start by talking about your background and where you were born.
Well, I was born in Youngstown, of course, St. Elizabeth's Hospital. Well, home was here on, at that time, was on 7th Street in Struthers. We moved from there to from 7th Street in Struthers to Maplewood, Uncle Frank's house. I can remember my mother telling me about my two uncles came to visit my dad, and they were Irishmen, and they were drunk all the time. So one day my dad went to work and they went down to get a bottle. She threw all their clothes out, went and locked the house up. They never did come back. But anyways, from there we moved to Wilson Street in Struthers. Then we moved to Creed Street. And I was about 6 years old when we moved to Creed Street. And that was our permanent home there. That was called Dogtown in those days. Because everybody in the plat, there was a sheet and tube plat, the company owned houses. Well, we were buying our home. They were company owned houses. Company built houses. And everybody had a dog. Called Dogtown, of course. Up in Youngstown, Paul Rose called Hunky Town. And my wife now, she came from Cook Alley. And there was Pink Tea Hill and Homecrest. All these areas had their ethnic groups that lived there. They all got those names from there. And
I heard of Cook Alley before, but this is the first I've ever heard of some of these others.
Oh, yeah. Pink Tea Hill, that was all the big shots right down here, you know. And of course, we had Nebo. It's named after Mount Nebo over on the other side. You were familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I never knew it was Mount Nebo was came from the Bible until just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And
was your father from Struthers too?
No, my dad came from Niles, and he was a policeman for the Sheet and Tube.
Oh, he worked for Sheet and Tube.
Uh-huh. And he worked for 27 years, and he got multiple sclerosis and had to quit. My mother is originally from Farrell, Pennsylvania. And a young girl, she came over here to visit some of her cousins and met my dad and started that romance. And they got married at St. John's Cathedral in Cleveland. That's about that part of it.
Okay, where did you go to school? Here in Struthers? At the public school in
Struthers? Yeah, we went to Lion Platt School, and then when St. Nicholas School opened up, sent us there and went to Struthers High School, graduated from there. And
what year did you graduate?
1935. And then, strangely enough, I was going to work for a year and make some money and be a history professor. And you might think I'm conning you, but that is the guy's truth. And but my dad got multiple sclerosis, and that meant that I had to family because there was no pensions or anything at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So my mother just gave me allowance, and then came time for the Army. And the draft board told me that either I had to go or my brother had to go. My brother just turned 18, so I said I'd go. And so I went in the Army, 42. 6 months later, the draft board took him. There, that poor father of mine, helpless. My mother had to wash him and feed him and clean him.
Were there just the two boys in your family?
Yeah, just two boys.
Any girls? Any sisters?
Yeah, I had my sister, Tootsie. My dad always called her Tootsie, and Peg. And course, Toots was married when I went to the Army. And my sister Peg worked on the rod and wire, the sheet and tube plant down in Struthers.
During the war.
And she married some soldier from this camp out here in Sharon. Went to Missouri with him. And then divorced him. I don't know whatever happened there. It was all while I was in the Army. So she reminds me of an aunt I had. I had an Aunt June that was married 8 times.
Oh.
And when she was filing for Social Security, she had to look up all of her husbands. And she said to me, "Honest to God, Jim, there was some of them there I didn't even remember." That was a woman, though, that God loved her. I'm telling you, she drank, ran around, whored around. She did everything she wanted to do. And by God, she lived to be 76 years old. And she enjoyed every day of her life.
Well,
so but sometimes, what the hell, you might as well do what you want to do instead of what society wants you to do.
That's right. So what about your Army days? Where did you serve?
Let's see. Well, I went to the Army, and I was stationed at Camp Fort Hays, Columbus, because at that time I was on limited service on kind of eyesight. And that town was so good for the GI that I missed so many reveilles that they sent me the infantry in Texas. And Fort Hays, we had hospital rations. That means, you know, you'd have roast pork and chocolate cake and wonderful food. I'd have stayed there forever if I could have. We should have.
What did you do while you were
there? I was in supply there, furnishing, equipping all the GIs in this area. They went there and they were supplied with their clothing and then shipped out to various camps throughout the country. And then when we went down to Texas, all I got was corn pone and hominy grits and pork. Oh, God.
Things changed.
Sure did. And they ran my behind off. And then I became a supply sergeant down there. So that's what it ended up. I was a supply sergeant for practically all the 4 years. And we was at Camp Cook, Camp Kellen, Camp San Luis Obispo, and then we shipped out of Camp Miles Standish in Massachusetts, went to Camp Old Gold France, then we went all through Belgium, Holland, to get to Germany. And that's where we did our fighting, was in Germany, because we didn't do any fighting in France or Belgium or Holland. And then there was the fear of Hitler setting up the last ditch campaign in Bavaria. That is, what'd they call that, the Eagle's Nest? I forget now, mine's dim on that, but it was his summer home in Bavaria.
Oh, yes, I know.
And that's where we went down to Austria. And from Austria, while we came back to Mannheim, Verheim, back to Camp Old Gold, France, and came home. And we were the first division to come home intact. But Jim got drunk in Philadelphia, and I missed the train. I never got my picture in the paper. Oh. Well, was my mother worried? Oh, my God. She knew what, you know, what outfit I belonged to and everything. And got back for 30 days. Went to some... Oh, Camp Gruber, Oklahoma. We stayed there for about 30 days, and then I got shipped out to the Philippines. And I was in the Philippines about a year. I thought I'd never get home. 4 years.
That's a long time.
Yeah, and I remember we stayed there at Camp Callan's on San Diego, and I thought it was a you ought to stay here. This weather is so wonderful down here. And I would have, but everybody was here. Of course, Dad had died in 42. But my mother and sisters, aunts and uncles, they were all here, and I came back here. And that's about, well, I did get cited for bravery in Germany. But that was about all. I never even got so much as a mosquito bite.
Well, you were lucky.
Never, nothing. Before, this poor fellow next door to me, now he's dying of cancer. He got a kidney shot out. He was over in Germany. Wonderful man. He goes up to the hospital 1 week out of every four for chemotherapy. Stays up there for a whole week. Mm-hmm. So
then you got out of the Army what year? When the war was over?
Yeah, when the war was over, 46. And went back to work almost immediately.
You worked before you went into the
Army? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where did you work at?
A sheet and tube. I was in the, well, first I started up the seamless, which is still going now. But
was this straight out of high school then?
Yeah, right, straight out of high school. I lost a week's work. My dad couldn't understand that. He took me and, times are still hard. He took me and my best friend that I'd had since first year in school, Frank Soule was his name, and took me and him down to see the general manager of the sheet and tube. And word came back that I would be hired, but Frank wouldn't. And it wasn't until years and years later that we found out that because his dad had communist ties when he was a young man. And of course, that time they were Italians, and they were more or less discriminated against. They kept searching for something too, you know. And I guess they were fringe communists is what they would be. But they wouldn't give Frank a job. And so he got one up Republic. And then right before the war, well, he applied for a job in the U.S. Mail. And before he was called, the Army got him. He went the Air Corps all through China Burma Theater. And he came back and they didn't call him. They went right around him. They had to go up and fight over it.
You mean the post office?
Yeah, the post office wouldn't hire him for some reason or other. Never did find out why there, but anyways, they finally did hire him. And he just retired here maybe 6 or 8 months ago. He had been chief personnel officer for the whole district. Hmm. He was very intelligent.
So you worked how long at the sheet and tube before you went to the Army then?
Let's see. 35 to 42, 7 years.
7 years. Mm-hmm. In the seamless?
No. I worked 4 years in the seamless. And at that time, times were tough. The Depression was really still on. Mm-hmm. And I had to keep the family going, and I wasn't getting any time, wasn't making any money. So I decided to go down and see the superintendent of the plant protection, my dad's old job, old department. And I went down and I asked him for a job. And he says, well, he says, I don't know, maybe tomorrow, maybe next week, maybe next year. I said, I can't promise you anything. And geez, I no sooner got home, they called up and told me to start to work that afternoon. And I stayed there for the rest of the time.
And that was how long?
That was 35 years there, 44 years altogether.
44 years of sheet and tube.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's a long time.
Yeah. Oh, it was a good company. Really a good company.
During those years, when you say it was tough, was production pretty slow. When you say you didn't get enough time, it just wasn't the work available.
It wasn't the work
available.
So
you only worked a certain amount of days.
Yeah, and then too, I was a young man that very independent, even though I had dependents to keep. But there was no union at that time, and if you bought the boss a drink after work, you worked. If you bought a bag of tomatoes, you worked. And of course, old Jim, he didn't do things like that, and he didn't work. And that was the story then. I was one of the first to join the union up in the seamless. But then, of course, when I got the job in the plant protection line, there was no union there.
Was there ever a union? I mean, sooner or later there was a union.
Oh, yeah. We got, later on, we had our own independent union. And then we joined the CIL, Steelworkers Union. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure glad because, boy, a pension of 44 years is pretty nice.
I bet it is, yeah. Mm-hmm. Can you remember by any chance when you first started working at Sheet and Tube? What you made, an hour or a week or whatever?
Yeah, I made, well, that time labor's wage was 37.5 cents an hour, but I started out at 60.5 cents an hour because I got in the inspection department, and they gave you that increase because there was no bonus. That was just straight time. Mm-hmm. But 60.5 cents an hour is what I made.
What was that?
About $5 a day? Or?
Considered pretty good for those times,
yeah,
though. I imagine
yeah.
that was not.
It considered
not
pretty good money. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 37.5 cents an hour. That's terrible. Then I think after that first strike, I think they got a 4 cent an hour raise or something like that. Everybody, which wasn't much.
No. Over the years. What kind of changes did you see come about just in general? I realize you weren't working in the steel mill itself, or were you? I mean, did you, in your job, did you like work the gates or?
I worked the gates most of the time. It wasn't too long until when I came back from the Army that I got in supervision in our department, which meant that I had the whole district.
Now you're talking about plant protection.
Plant protection.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
You were in plant protection before you went to the service?
No.
When you came back?
I beg your pardon. No, I was in plant protection before I went to the service.
You were. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I was, I think about 3 years in plant protection when I went to the service. And I was at the gates at that time, patrolling, then the gates. And then after the war, I went back, and frankly, I was only one of the few young men to be in the department when I was hired at the time in that department. Everybody else was very, very old. And when I got back into service then, when practically all of them were retiring or dying, and I moved up quite rapidly. And I think mostly it was because the superintendent and my dad had been very good friends. Possibly not too much my ability, but I did have quite a bit of Army training by then, which they liked. But they did like my dad. My dad really paved my way throughout the whole Sheet and Tube. He was well known and well liked. That means a lot. Mm-hmm. And I did see a lot of changes. Saw the seamless mills change over to the American system from the German system. Saw new strip mills go in, and modernize. I saw the whole Sheet and Tube. I think was modernized about 3 times while I was there. With new equipment. Then of course, when the place took over, well, they took all of our capital with them.
Yeah, it seems to be.
And you know, I was the only politician in the valley at that time. I was the fourth ward councilman. I was the only politician in the whole valley that protested the Lakes takeover of the Sheet too. Not among anybody else. Not one said a word. And I tried to get formal resolutions passed in City Council down in Struthers, and they refused to leave the duty on the floor.
Why do you think that was?
They were afraid of the company.
Afraid?
So they were, most of them were sheep dupe employees. And they were all bucking all the time. And, of course, by that time, I was all bucked out. I just didn't care then. But I did, and I remember one time the union paper mentioned the fact that no politicians questioned the Likes takeover, and including them. And I wrote them a letter and told them. They came out with the next edition of acknowledging that I did.
Mm-hmm.
I kept all that stuff, and after a while, I threw it away. Mm-hmm. Like all the letters and stuff from the 18 years as councilman, who cares?
You never know.
Yeah, like when I got in, the fourth ward came to about the next street over. And during my 18 years, the darn ward doubled in size. Till I was half the city. And Fifth Street up here was just a country road. I had a widened, curbed, sidewalked, and then the plaza came in. But who knows that today?
That's right.
No one gives that. My kids don't even give a damn.
Yeah. Well.
And, you know, like $500,000 sewer going through here. I got that so that we could develop all the area up in there. Otherwise, we couldn't. There's no kind of drainage.
So a lot of community work really goes unnoticed. You know, a lot of time you can put into that type of thing, and honest, all you ever hear is what goes wrong.
Honest to God, Elner says that I never saw the kids grow up because I was gone all the time. But frankly, I was the only politician at that time that really was doing anything. It was always here. And everybody wanted street lights, they wanted fire hydrants, they wanted the streets paved, they wanted sidewalks, and water problems. And then they'd fight about utilities. And I still write letters to the editor.
Well, that's good.
Get it out of my system.
That's good. Describe what the mill was like in its heyday when it really was at its top production. Now, I don't know, those years differ from time to time, but in the 60s, I guess, it was really at its, pretty much at its peak.
Well, I can say one thing, there were happy days, because everybody was happy. They were all making money, they were working. Pardon me. Now, there are some employees that slack off.
Did you see a change in the employees, in the type of worker over the years, from when you first began to till now? You think the older employee had more of a sense of responsibility or hard worker than?
They were, yes. The older employee was a harder worker. Because at that time, there was no unions, and the boss was strictly the boss. If you didn't like it, you were fired. And, but even after that, the older men were more, of course, reserved, and they did work. And there was nobody crazier than me when my younger days when I was down there. But these young men, though, after a while, they get married, they have children, and then they're the same as the men before them. And then the next generation coming up, they're the same way, just crazier than hell. And all they think about is goofing around and making money, running around. But then too, then again, they settle down. They marry, have children, or even just get older. And they all turn out to... Most of the workers are, you know, I can honestly say in those years I was down there, in my type of work too, as so many ethnic groups. And that includes the Negro, which was very maligned against. I can't honestly say that I disliked one person. Now, of course, I'll say my superintendent. We got a new superintendent I didn't get along with. But I just asked for a reduction and got away from him. Because he and I would have come to blows if we had stayed together. So I just left him. But maybe he's the closest one I could say that I ever disliked down there. But as far as the workers themselves, everybody treated me fine, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. I might be unusual in saying that, but...
We started talking about your job before. Exactly what were your responsibilities? What did your job entail? Describe your...
My job mostly as supervisor was entailed. Supervising the men at the gates and the men at the mill. To see that they produced their work entailed them to watch for safety conditions that would injure the men not observing safety rules, and of course theft, the big thing. Later on, why our department got into drugs, and which they tell me now they have our men stationed firmly down the Copeland with a kind of drug problem. But that's since my time. But
this whole time you stayed in the Camel Works. That's where you.
Yeah. And then I was promoted to fire chief for the whole district. They told me I had to take it or else, and I hated that job with a passion. I could never be a fireman. And of course, what was during that time? That was our heyday too. That was in the 60s. Everything was going full blast, and I'm telling you, I was called out 4 and 5 times a week from home to answer the fires, the mill. And even today when that phone rings, I just go crazy. And I hate that job. Finally, I told him to stick it. That's when I left. Went back to the gates.
Oh, you did?
Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of glad, too, because, let's see, that was in 62. And I retired in 79. It was 17 more years, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And all that time, I was back under the union again. So, if I'd have stayed fire chief, though, I'd have been gone long ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, when they first started reducing their forces. Because I had the time to go. I was in long enough to get a pension. They would force me to go. So I stayed in, completed my 44 years. And then we had this hassle to shut the place down. Somehow the union and the company got together, the employment office, and I don't know how they got the agreement together with them and the unemployment bureau, but they told me that if I'd be 62 in a few months, that if I retired, I would be eligible for TRA for 18 months on top of my pension and Social Security. And, TRA amounts to $536 every 2 weeks. So,
that's a sizable amount.
That's $1,072 a month for 18 months. And on top of my Social Security, on top of my Sheet 2 pension. We had more money than we ever had.
So really, for you, it had kind of a positive...
That was the only time I think I ever got a good break. It just happened the right time. And,
Would you have retired at 62 had this shutdown not come? Or would you have worked longer?
I think I'd have worked longer.
Do you?
Yeah, because I had a pleasant job. I had a pleasant job, and nobody was hassling me. I mean, my supervisors were all fine people, and the men I worked with were fine people, and the job was a good job, a pleasant job. In fact, I read about 5 hours out of 8. Nobody bothered me, and I was in a position where I could do my job and read. And I loved that job. In fact, I bid on it for that purpose. But I would have stayed, I think. Because this gets me going sometimes here.
Well, you're a young man, yeah.
Yeah. Then, of course, another factor it might have been also is that I did have a heart attack, and that job did entail getting out into the weather, and I find myself very short-winded in this kind of weather. I had the darn heart attack, and I quit smoking, and I got myself a pot belly. I had a hell of a time.
Would you have had any choice if you decided you really didn't want to retire? Could they have put you somewhere else? Could you have been transferred? Or did they give you no choice? Or did that go along seniority lines?
No, that was all strictly seniority.
Okay. If you would have wanted to work a few more years, could you have gone to Briar Hill or someplace else where?
Well, my job was working. My job still worked.
It was?
Yeah. My job was working when I left.
But you chose, really, you based your retirement on the benefits to it, the
mm-hmm.
TIA and...
TRA.
TRA, rather, the supplemental thing.
Yeah, I was going to retire very shortly, but I had it in mind, but my mind hadn't been made up. But the pressure was starting to get awfully, awfully bad with the younger people. They were just so... Even me going wouldn't have kept jobs, but it got so that after a while that the men in the department just couldn't stand me because I had the seniority and I had the years and
you mean you got the feeling they felt you should retire?
Oh yeah, they was putting pressure
to
make room for somebody else.
Oh.
But hell, when they start cutting, oh hell, I think they only have about 8 or 9 people left.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they had 60-some before. And me staying or going wouldn't have made that much difference with a huge majority of them. But everybody was jockeying. In fact, our union president is Walter Squires, or was Walter Squires, the mayor's assistant in Youngstown. Very bright person. Very, very bright. He's going to succeed in that job up there, too. But he's the one that made the arrangements for my TRA. So... In fact, I was working day turn, and it was just a stunned feeling. Everybody was just stunned. But of course, I was working in an area where we knew that the seam was going to keep on working, and I was working in an area that serviced the seamless. So our particular area wasn't too bad. But nothing could be, people just didn't talk too much about it. They were just more or less stunned. And of course, you know, I wrote another letter to the Vindicator on that. That's no, Mitchell permitted the merger of what the hell is it, lights and the sheet and tube. Of course, I blamed it on politics.
You did?
Well, here's the Likes people down in New Orleans. And I mentioned this in the letter. Likes people in New Orleans. Here's Senator Long, one of the most powerful senators in the country. And here was Nixon. And of course, with that triumvirate, nobody up here could get any information on the union. And what Likes wanted was our money. I think we had about $200 million at that time in liquid assets. What they wanted to do is get that, and of course they bought a bank and they bought an insurance company. And I think they fixed up some of their boats with sheet and tube money and with taxpayers' money. But it didn't cost them anything from my viewpoint. So their boats were highly subsidized by the taxpayer. But I think there was a deal between Nixon and Mitchell and Long and Likes to get that merger. Because how could a small company like Likes, I know it's been done before, swallow a monster like Sheet and Tube without those people helping? And now Likes ended up by being one of the chief stockholders of LTV. Mm-hmm. So.
What did you see as the role of the Youngstown Sheet and Tube owners at that time? Think they really had a choice, or do you think they really were kind of forced in a corner to sell or merge rather?
You know, I could never really quite fathom what was going on, but I do remember one time I was up the Manicor, and over in the corner I don't think I've been in the Manicor 3 times in my life. I was up here this night, and you know, from my position, the cheat to the fan protection, I knew all the big shots. And I looked over in the corner, and there was Glossbrenner, used to be president of Sheet Tube, and Robert Williams, the present president of Sheet Tube at that time. And they sat over in the corner with a pitcher of beer, and they talked, and they talked, and they talked. Now, nobody can say what their role was. I know Williams must have had something to do in that role. But he would never say, never get a statement out of him that I can remember. In fact, nobody around the company would make any statements. I don't know, can you remember? I can't remember any statements, and I was really hip on that. I tried to follow it closely. But what the tactics were, I don't know. Except they offered the stockholders and the bondholders a premium. And they sold out to them. And then they paid with our money.
Did you see a change right away in the mill itself after the merger?
Yeah, I think that was the time then when right after that, just soon the word came out, things started going downhill rapidly. You couldn't get any supplies, no parts. I'm quoting the maintenance people because I wasn't in a position to know. But these people would complain about they couldn't get their machines fixed, they couldn't get cranes fixed, they couldn't get rolls fixed. And actually, if we didn't have a good machine shop at that time, I think things would have deteriorated more rapidly. But we had some of the best craftsmen in the world in the sheet and tube. Now they're scattered all over the country. And they would make the parts instead of purchasing them. But people started getting to the point where they just didn't care much what was going on. They figured it was, their fate has been decided, and they're just going to ride it out. But it was a shame, especially, we started getting a lot of women in, too. And that's what I often remarked. When I was a young man, they started hiring women in the sheet and tube, and I went to the Army. In 4 years, I came back, and the women were going. Now I got to become an old man, they started hiring a young woman again, and I was going. And then they went.
So you think kind of the attitude of the workers changed, too, after that merger?
I think so, yeah. Just, who gives a damn?
People I've talked to seem to have had a really good sense of loyalty with Youngstown Sheet and Tube when it was Youngstown Sheet and Tube and locally owned. They really seemed to have that loyalty to the company and thought it was really a good company. You think most of the workers felt that way?
I do think so. It sounds strange in this day of high finance and big companies and conglomerates and that. But I think that the men at the sheet and tube had a deep sense of loyalty toward the company. And and even the I'd say our top supervisors did also. And there wasn't such a thing as constantly moving top supervision around. Usually they came in and they stayed. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have even that plant protection department of ours, which was one of the lowest paid down there. Why, we had very little movement as far as leaving for better jobs. And they were a lot of good jobs down. When you were in production, the open hearths and blast furnaces and strip mills, they paid real good money, excellent money. And it seemed like we always seemed to work better than the steel mills around us.
What do you think?
I don't know. Now, maybe that wasn't true. Maybe it's just our idea. But it seems to me, as a rule, we did better. We worked steadier than the steel industry as a whole. And of course, we made the best pipe in the world. That seamless tube up there made the best pipe, I would say, in all honesty, you can find any place. I used to work at the gates, and these huge trucks would come out carrying those 45 foot lengths. Boy, you'd look at that, and it'd be all shiny and glossy and straight as a die. And those men were craftsmen. You'd hear them over the taverns, it's good. They hated their jobs, they hated their bosses, they hated everything, but all they could talk about was their jobs. Mm-hmm. That's all they could talk about. And that's the old saying about, more steel's rolled in the tavern than there is in the strip mills. But yeah, I think it was that part also that, the English language is a great uniter, you get in a bar and everybody, no matter what ethnic group you are, you speak English, and but that's going off again. And they talk over their jobs. They talk over their problems. But there were some workers up there that were quitter. They get good turns out, you know, and their next guy come on, do the very same job, they do have a bad turn. But they wouldn't tell each other the secrets.
No?
No. They wouldn't tell each other the secrets. You hadn't learned it yourself. Sometimes just turn a little screw, you know, an inch or so. But they were jealous of their jobs, and they were proud of their work, of their jobs. Yeah, proud of their company, too. That was a sin, what happened.
Did you see it coming? Do you think most men really saw it coming?
Not in the shape that it happened. But I think that they sensed. At least I did, I know. Sensed that you get somebody, strangers, ruin your company, and you know they're part of a huge conglomerate. And the history of big business being what it is, you're kind of wary of what's going on. You're kind of hesitant, kind of suspicion that the times aren't going to be as good in the future as they were in the past. Now, see, Nixon is going to, or not Nixon, but Reagan is going to de-emphasize white-collar crime and go after crimes of violence. Well, that's all right, too, but we're going to get back to the days of big steel, big chemical companies doing just what they want to do without fear of anything. I've got a Fortune magazine in there now. An article about the crimes all these companies have committed in the last couple of years. Nobody goes to jail. They get fined. Nobody goes to jail. You know darn well it's got to be men that make those decisions.
That's right. So you don't think anyone really thought they would actually shut down the way they did? Maybe
no.
A slowdown, but not really a...
If there was going to be a shutdown, of course, we had departments shut down before. Shut down completely. Like the rod mill went down. They shut down the rod mill, the nail mill, electric weld, and Emperor never started them up again. And it was hard to understand. They shut down the nail mill, down the rod and wire, because of lack of business, and U.S. Steel was just opening up a new nail mill. Never could figure that out. But they figured if something was going to happen, it wouldn't be their department. When they shut down, it wouldn't be their department. Somebody else's.
Do you think the company should have given these men warning that this was coming, rather than all at once?
I think it was really fair that they would have. Because, I'll tell you frankly, when the shutdown came, the sheet tube was going full blast. Men were working 6 days a week, 7 days a week, all kinds of overtime. Everything was going full blast. And all of a sudden, bam, shutdown came. No warning, no nothing.
Do you think there were other causes besides the merger and likes and draining off the assets and so forth? Do you think just the economic situation or the government restrictions or EPA, do you think all that kind of contributed?
No, I don't.
Don't you? You think they could have survived?
They could have survived because, look at here, we've got Sharon Steele, we got the Republican one. And we have, what's that French company now out there? Makes steel, specialty steel. It's a huge company, but France just bought it. So the French, is that famous Jewish banking firm?
I don't know, I'm not familiar.
And they have, they own banks in England and France, and it was in Germany and Austria. Anyways, they bought this company. But they're all land-bound. Mm-hmm. They all have the same problems a sheep and tube would have. They're all healthy and all growing stronger and stronger. And they all have the same problems with the government and the EPA and with the freight charges. And they're all healthy, but yet the sheep and tube couldn't survive. And it's hard to figure out. I've noticed through the years that companies don't fail because of the unions or the government. It's top management usually ruins a company, and that has happened through our history. It's top management has ruined companies. Wrong decisions. Just like I read in the paper today, where Hyatt gets another raise in their rates because they're going to not build 4 nuclear plants that they thought they had needed. But we have to pay for what's been done so far. Now that's management's decisions.
You're paying.
And we have to pay for their. It should be the stockholder that pays for them. They own the company, not the customer. But management has always been at fault, in my opinion. The union and the worker has never ruined a company. And look at what Chrysler employees are doing now. They're giving up millions and millions of dollars worth of benefits. And the problem with Chrysler, it was not the employees, it was management. That was Ford's problem, too. You can blame all this problem, I think, on management. Try to make the American public buy big cars, and they didn't want it.
When a company like Sheet and Tube pulls out of an area the way they did, do you think steel companies or any big companies has a responsibility to the community as far as where do you think their responsibility lies? Because, say, Camel, for instance, Anstruther's, their tax base really came from the Camel Works. Do you think the company owes that community?
Well, you know, they provide a job for you, and they pay you, and they maintain that's all they owe you. And maybe that's true, but communities will build roads to sustain heavy traffic. They will endure smoke, stench, for the sake of their tax base. And the companies, without a question, like don't put into the community as much as they take out. I can remember years ago when we had a snow. Well, the next morning you'd look out and the snow would be black. Now, you don't deserve to live in a community like that. When there's ways to clean up the air, if there isn't, yeah, But if there's ways to clean up the air and the water and everything, I believe the companies are should be made to do it. Because after all, who pays the bill but us? It's a customer. And what I was thinking of as a special example was when they're building Southern Park Mall out there. The county commissioners authorized new roads all around that mall. Notice all those roads, how wide they are, big and beautiful. Well, that was done to accommodate DiBartolo and his mall. And the money they spent out there, they took off the other communities for, they couldn't, that the next few years, they couldn't do any road work because they spent all their money out there for him. I'm glad it's out there, don't get me wrong, but he should have paid for all that. Here in Struthers, you want a road improved, you had to pay for it. The city won't put it in for nothing. But I've seen cities spend money for the companies. And they owe it to the community. To at least warn them something's going to happen. The schools are the ones that take the brunt of it, and the property tax. Yeah, I digress too much there.
No, not at all. I think a lot of the people that were affected by this left, or do you now in looking back, let me rephrase that. When this first happened, there was really kind of a panic type feeling. Now that it's been a few years and looking back, do you think the area has been affected as much as people originally thought?
People seem to have accommodated the whole thing. Of course, everyone close to me is still working. My son-in-law works up at Seamless. My nephew's still working down the sheet and tube, or LTD, or whatever you want to call it. Everyone close to me is still working. So it didn't affect me that much, except my son here isn't working, but the job he quit, still working. The company shut down, the sheet tube's still working. And the job that he quit, they made $30,000 last year. But they earn it. They work like dogs.
So there's still parts of the mill that are working.
Uh-huh. Yeah, our cold drawn up to Briar Hill, and the Seamless and the shipping, and we're also shipping small pipe out. They ship us from Aliquippa to here, and they ship it out of here someplace else to fill orders. And of course, the coke plant's a big money maker. Geez, the last I heard, they were getting $145 a ton for coke. Must be more than that now. But somebody tells me that our coke yard down there, it's fenced in, there's a sign on it, property of Sharon Steel. So I haven't been down to look at it down the street. We had a huge coke yard right there by the main road. But Sharon Steel doesn't have a coke plant. No. And this would be a good place to get their coke. So I don't know what that it means down there.
In the beginning, there was a lot of talk of workers buying the plants and trying to run them themselves, and then there was the ecumenical coalition. Do you think that that type of thing gave people false hope? Or do you think they really and truly believed they could pull it off, so to speak, and get the mills running again?
Well, you know, I honestly think that it could have been done. We still had all of our skilled people in this valley. We still had all of our skilled managers in this valley. And it seems awfully strange we could give billions of dollars to foreign aid and billions of dollars fighting the Vietnam War, which ended up was useless, not worth a damn. And they couldn't give us $300 million to keep this place going down here. And at that time, yeah, because we had all of our skilled people still here. Now I would say it'd be very difficult because they're scattered all over the place. But I really feel that the rest of the steel industry, in connivance with the federal government, didn't want that to happen. They didn't want a viable steel plant in this area.
Why?
Well, you know, the less competition you have, the better position you're in to keep your prices up. And that seems to be the name of the game today, is to keep the prices up. They tell me that's one of the reasons why we have high prices today, is because they're afraid that price controls will go on. They would be stuck with a low price if they didn't. Maybe it sounds like the dark age the way I'm talking, but I really feel that. Well, maybe it's because I have read so much in my lifetime about the ills of big business and management, the corruption of government. Maybe if I hadn't read so much, I wouldn't have that attitude, but I know it could be done. Those decisions could be done quickly in corner offices, in the state houses, and in the Capitol.
It really affects a lot of people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
It changes a lot of lifestyles.
Oh, boy. Yeah, I was lucky again with that TRA, because old Nixon's going to cut it out. That's when he figured there's too much TRA. Well, maybe there is. But again, why should the government pay TRA for mistakes the government has made?
Well, if you look at it that way, I can say that.
Yeah. If foreign imports have hurt various companies, raise the tariff then. But they won't do it. There's too many angles in all this business. Angles that I'll never know.
I think in general the benefits were good, though, to the man who did lose his job in that shutdown. Do you think what they offered him was fair?
I never gave much thought for somebody else. I always thought mine was, but I was more fortunate. Now, I do have a nephew by marriage, my wife's nephew by marriage, a first-class welder, and top worker, skilled, very skilled and energetic, good worker. And there's a craftsman there. You can't get a job, please. He's working with the street department for Borden right now under the CETA program.
Would he leave the area if he
could? I don't know. His wife's mother told me once that he did have an opportunity to get a job, but she would leave the area. His wife would leave the area. And she is a mother's girl. She and her mother are very close. But like my wife and I talked over, if I lost my job and had to go someplace else, she'd have to go with me. Because it's tough to pick up your roots and go, but by God, you've got to go where you can make a living.
Why do you think people in this area seem to be reluctant to move? That seems to be, people seem to be, have a very strong feeling about staying here.
Well, I can speak for myself, and I think that the reason is that this area, the potpourri, I hope that's the right word, for all the nationalities of the world. And these first generations came over here. They come over here because they had no land and no homes, and they had to have a better life. And they came over here, got jobs in steel mills, got a few bucks ahead, bought a home, bought land, raised their families. And I think it's the family instincts that are still in this valley, the close-knit families, that make people want to stay here. They have their churches, and they have their parochial schools. They have close ties to public schools. They have their mothers and their fathers, their uncles and their aunts. And I think the children pick up that same feeling that the first and second generation people have of wanting to be just part of this area. This area belongs to them, of course. The state belongs to them, the country belongs to them. But I think that it's family ties that hold them close here. Well, look at my wife and I. She was born and raised here. I was born and raised here. Like I said, I moved two blocks away from my mother, and my daughter moved two blocks away from me. And she's up here every day, practically. Kids stop almost every day, going home from school. And I can remember when Judy graduated from St. Nicholas School, she wanted to go to Mooney. At that time, I had lost my job down there, my supervisor's job. Says, no, she's got to go to the high school. Oh, she cried and raised Kate. And hey, your mother went there, I went there. good school. We had close ties. And so finally she went. She's within a week, she was running the class. She loved every day of it.
What do you think the future is for the Valley here as far as steel making is concerned?
I think we'll always have a little bit of steel making in this valley.
Yeah.
I understand now they're getting ready to put some electric furnaces in where the old open hearths are down there. And see, one thing, this area is a large steel consuming area. And it would pay to make steel here to a certain extent. Of course, we don't have the huge consuming area that the Chicago area has, may say, but we're heavily populated. We're close to the eastern seaboard. We consume a lot of steel. Not nearly like we did before. But somebody was telling me the new furnaces Sharon Steel's putting out there can knock off a 350-ton heat in 80 minutes. Jeez, we used to knock off a, take 6 to 8 hours and knock off a 90-ton heat. Of course, that was a long, long time ago before they improved the furnaces.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about that we didn't really touch upon?
No, I think
in general.
I think you covered everything pretty well. No, except with the being a good Democrat, you know, I'm kind of discouraged with the administration's ideas, but
we'll have to wait and see. What about Carter's role in all this when the 5,000 were laid off that one day? Do you think his role in this was, do you think he did the right thing, handled it the right way, or do you think he should have, like you say, if we spent money for Vietnam and everything else, do you think he should have been a little more committed?
I well, of course, because I'm committed to this area, that I feel that we were cheated. But you know, his attorney general Bell did the very same thing that, that Nixon's attorney Mitchell did, would permit access to any of the records. We got give out no information on the new merger of LTD and Lakes, and I don't think that. Carter in that area did any better than Nixon did, or what Ford would have done. Very disappointing to me that he was like he was on that. But again, like I say, there are powerful people down there in Washington that we think the president is powerful, but there are other powerful people in Washington that, especially the high-class Washington attorney firms down there. They really run Washington. Isn't that a beautiful dog? Kevin started clipping her the other day, and his girlfriend called him, and off she went.
Feel you want to add anything to it later, just give me a call.
Well, if you think of anything, why just give me a call.
Okay.